Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 16th of May, and I'm recording at 10:15 p.m., and that's British summertime. Now, this being Friday, this is a big picture long-term outlook at the various asset classes. But first, let's just have a little quick look at what's happened here this week. And there are always worries, aren't there, in markets? And so people have been nervous about the low government bond yields. They've been nervous about global GDP growth, and the connection with the global bond yields is thinking that maybe there's too much deflation around, and maybe global GDP growth is going to continue to be slow. That'll go being a long concern, long-running concern, I should say. It already is, and I'll have more to say about that in a moment. People are a bit concerned about U.S. stock market valuations, and with some reason. They're not excessive, but they are high relative to what we see elsewhere around the world. And they're also, they are high because the market's been moving up more than corporate profits have been growing in this slow global economy. And corporate profits have also been flattered by share buybacks, as we know. So, That's the background picture, and elsewhere, government bond yields really remain quite low. There's plenty of liquidity around generally, and currencies mostly stable in here overall. Japanese yen is a little bit too steady for the Japanese stock market right now, and there are lots of concerns over last month's tax increase and the future of their energy policies. But overall, this has been a generally good environment here for investors. And let's take the global growth situation, which continues to be of concern to so many commentators. My feeling is that the global economies are doing pretty much what you'd expect after a really vicious credit crisis recession, such as we saw in 2008. And it's not hard to explain that, because when you get a collapse like that really seriously threatened to take down banking systems, corporations went into survival mode. Private investors cut spending dramatically in an attempt to deleverage. I mean, massively overall, we had a big deleveraging campaign right across the globe. And that is certainly not going to help global GDP growth. And it's also hard to restart global GDP growth in the years that follow a major credit crisis recession. I've said this on many occasions, but there are always new subscribers coming in, and it's always worth reviewing. And so I'll just stay with this point a little longer. The economists, people like Rogart and Reinhoff and others, have said that it takes at least five years following a credit crisis recession for global GDP growth to get back to anything like normal. And they'll say that about individual economies as well that experience a separate credit crisis recession. But this was more of a global credit crisis recession, so that takes even longer. And if we look at the U.S. economy, for instance, we're now early into the sixth year of that post-crisis recovery period overall, and it could easily be another 2, 3 years. Some people are saying it may be 10 years. We can only guess at this stage, but it's going to take longer, as we can see right now from the data that we're getting, and that is, I would say, not a new crisis or a new normal beyond the lengthy medium term, but it is typical, as I've said before, with what actually happens following these big credit crises. So, how does it change, or what changes it? First, that consumers deleverage, and that they do that over a period of years. Unemployment tends to go up, and so that makes consumers more hesitant as well. And they certainly haven't had the same earnings increases that have taken place in some stronger periods of economic activity. And so that keeps consumers relatively cautious. They also saw drops in house prices in many countries. Prices in housing values fell on all but the most popular of cities, and that doesn't lead to increased consumer spending. Then corporations, again, having been in survival mode, have been very cautious. And their main interest was in deleveraging as well. That meant shedding some employment that they felt was superfluous. And it also led to a huge effort to replace workers with smart machines. And that's part of the accelerating rate of technological innovation, and this is a relatively big problem here, because the machines are getting smarter at a faster rate than new jobs are actually created. I think one of the answers to this is that we'll see a lot more people in self-employed or semi-self-employed roles in the future. But I'll stick with corporations here for the moment. Global GDP growth is slow, so they're a little bit more cautious. But corporates have actually done best in this environment because they've had the low interest rates, and having completed their deleveraging fairly early on, and benefiting most from the accelerated rate of technological innovation, corporations with a global reach have done quite well over the last few years, and that's been a good area to be invested, not least in the autonomies that this service likes so much. Then we go to from let's we're talking from consumers to corporations to governments. Governments have been weakened because they've seen a big drop in tax revenues, and that has created budget cuts. And where they haven't had budget cuts, we've seen government debt increase considerably. And so it's, again, it's a long, slow process of recovery that we're experiencing. But we're well down that road, and we probably have a few years further to go. But I'll emphasize this point that this is not a permanent new normal, as it's been fashionable to call it in some areas, and the longer term outlook is really quite attractive. Now, in terms of stock market valuations, and I said earlier that stock markets had done really quite well in this environment, and one of the main reasons is there's been so much liquidity around, and also a number of corporations had really quite attractive dividends. corporations have also been involved in the share buyback policy, and they've been able to replace, even before the share buybacks, they replaced an enormous amount of their debt with less costly debt overall. So the low interest rates have helped them enormously, as I've said. And this is a reasonably healthy environment, particularly for multinational corporations overall. But stock markets had run ahead. We know that from the increases that we've seen in valuations, not least in the United States. And that will lead to, given the uncertainties that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, and given the certainty that these quantitative easing programs are not going to go on forever. Indeed, the U.S. is going to wrap its QE purchases up later this year. And although interest rates will stay lower for an indefinite period, which I would say is likely to be at least another year, they will eventually move up as global GDP growth gradually improves over the next few years. And that will lead to somewhat turbulent conditions for stock markets. We've already seen turbulent conditions for stock markets. That's hardly a disaster. The big factor here is that I don't think we're likely to see another global bear market, anything like the scale of what we saw in 2000, early 2001, and like we saw in 2008 and the early part for some markets in 2009. Can we get a short statistical bear markets? Sure. Not least in emerging market economies, and we've already seen some of those. A lot of people tend to define a bear market as a 20% decline in a major index, and I think that's too tight a definition overall. We can easily see 20% corrections, and we already have seen a number of 20% corrections in emerging markets, some of which have then popped back really quite rapidly. But expect this choppy environment overall to continue for a while. And I've emphasized in recent months that one wants to be a little bit more conservative in investment policies. I think it's always dangerous to chase momentum moves when we get those big accelerations well above rising 200-day moving averages. You've seen that over and over again, and that's where technical analysis, it's not even analysis, it's just a matter of observation. When you see a fashionable share, and it's if particularly something that's been fashionable for quite some time, and when it eventually soars well above that rising 200-day moving average, you know that's going to end badly in the medium term, if not the not the short term, and can protect against that. We've seen that big shakeout in the U.S. of in terms of technology, particularly the biotechnology. But a lot of that of those new technology shares that were seeing huge momentum moves, but they didn't have much in the way of earnings, if any earnings, have given up a huge amount of ground. And those are, at a minimum, lengthy medium-term corrections. So the point about that is just be a little bit more conservative. And that, for me, means favor shares that have somewhat lower price-earnings ratios than their market indices, and also have decent yields. And even if you get caught out in a sudden shakeout, whether it was a predictable one or some accident that occurs, or exogenous event, that at least if you have that decent yield, you're paid for your patience. And I think also this is an environment. Well, I think this is a policy I'd always advocate, but the best time to buy. The best time to ever buy is when people are really terrified because a market or markets have been so weak. When you think about it, in a clear, calm, analytical environment, that's an obvious point. Behaviorally, it sounds counterintuitive very often at the time in the heat of the battle. When markets have had a big shakeout, people extrapolate forecasts to the downside. You get the real Cassandras who come out and suddenly hog the limelight and forecast that it'll go much, much lower. People are terrified. And they can very sadly, tragically, sell out of their positions at market lows. Does Warren Buffett do that? Absolutely not. And there's no reason why you should either. So it's buy low, sell high, and watch the charts, particularly weekly charts with those 200-day moving averages. And if a company that you feel reasonably confident in on a longer, medium to longer term basis has gone through a bad patch, or particularly if the market has gone through a bad patch and you've seen it accelerate below its 200-day moving average, then it may well have scope for an attractive medium-term recovery. And conversely, well, I've already mentioned the conversely side. When you get things that are way overextended, you need to use, if you're going to stay with them, you need to watch them very carefully and perhaps begin to scale out if you are a big investor. everybody's chasing them higher. Okay, which markets are going to look most interesting in here over the next few years? That's always a tough guess, but one that stands out for me, and you'll not be surprised to hear me say this now, is India. Narendra Modi's victory is absolutely stunning. There was certainly no consensus that he would get an absolute majority. Now, the counting and the tallying hasn't been finished yet, but it went on for a long time today, and it's quite clear that well, I'll put it this way: from all indications, it looks as if Narendra Modi is going to have more than a comfortable overall majority. Remember, I was talking about those 202 seats, and they may come in above. Above 300, which is an incredible achievement, and it's testimony to the abilities of the man in his efforts. Remember, he's the first person in the world who ever introduced a 3D hologram, so that he could be in one space, so one place, one studio, or on one stage, and have that broadcast all over the country. And it's also testimony to the extent to which the population in India was fed up with the corruption, about time too, rather than just being resigned and taking it for granted. Also, fed up with the weak economic performance, fed up with all that old socialist-style bureaucracy that was strangling India's economy, and also fed up to an extent with the caste system in India. And it was also fed up with some of the religious divisions because Modi's opponents made much of the fact that kept going back to that 2001 incident in Gujarat when Hindus killed a fair number of Muslims, I think over 1,000. And there were quite there was a lot of violence at that time. Well, Muslims voted in high numbers for Narendra Modi. He reached out to them successfully, and also people within some of the lower caste systems also, they liked this son of a tea worker. And who happens to be extremely bright, as you can see, ambitious, and economically savvy. And then they've got Rajam, I always struggle a little bit with those names, in the central bank, Bank of India. So what we actually have going forward now with India, it's, talk about a dramatic change. We've got a strong, popular prime minister who has a overall majority the first time in 30 years, and we have an outstanding central bank governor. Now, other countries should be so lucky. So my feeling is that there is plenty of money still on the sidelines that was we know that a lot of money has gone into India, and it went in really as soon as it became apparent that Narendra Modi was going to be leading the BJP. And there is a lot more money that could head India's way as well, particularly if the new government gets off to a reasonable start. And I'd be surprised if it I'd be surprised if it different didn't. So I think India could have a very good 5 years, and no doubt it'll be volatile at times, and that goes with it goes with the territory. But you may recall, I stayed on when I knew Modi was the candidate to lead the BJP, and I'm awfully glad I didn't. I have no intention of getting out right now. Similar to that, C. Owen's comments today on Indonesia, because Indonesia has an interesting leader. Who doesn't have quite the gravitas of Modi, but nevertheless, it's been a factor in Indonesia's significant recovery, as it's moving back up close to its previous peak. And Malaysia also benefiting from a governance issue. So I've probably said it 1,000 times, but governance is everything in markets. And if you have a new government and it's talking about, and more importantly, doing the right things, then that's going to be of interest to investors. Remember, it's a global beauty contest. Okay, now what else can we talk about here on a longer term basis, as far as stock markets is concerned? I've talked about several years of somewhat choppy activity. That's a buy low, sell high environment. I've already said that. I don't think that we need to live in too much fear of a major blowout, not on anything that's known here today. We still have that monetary tailwind, which is really quite attractive, and that will cushion the downside for most markets. So we have to have examples for markets to really do badly. I think we have to have appalling governance or some sort of exogenous event that causes a very dramatic shakeout, which would create a another good buying opportunity in all probability. On a much longer basis, I think we will be entering before the end of this decade. Well, starting point is always where's the where? How do you pick up the liftoff point? I would hope the valuations would improve somewhat during this choppy ranging period over the next few years that I'm anticipating. And beyond that, though, I think we'll see evidence of the beginning of a secular bull market. And the drivers for that, technological innovation, unbelievably exciting, and it's taking place at an accelerating pace. We all benefit from that, but corporations most of all. And so that will be one big driver. I'm also optimistic that we will see lower energy costs on a global basis. This isn't occurring on a uniform basis. The United States, of course, has a huge advantage in that department right now, and that's thanks to fracking. I'm just going to have a little sip of water, excuse me. Okay. So there certainly is the potential to have lower energy costs. Fracking is an important contributor to that. Natural gas, more efficient uses of energy, renewables coming on, and the runaway best renewable. There are many of them, as you know, but the runaway best one is the solar power, and I envisage a future where just about every country will see solar panels on all major buildings, other than cathedrals, perhaps. They mean you never know, and we will also see solar panels on plenty of homes, and the efficiency rate of these panels is increasing steadily. And there are forecasts that, well, it's right now, you can it's you know it's in the high 30s. Some are talking about the low 40% efficiency rates, but the projections are that the efficiency rate will go up to 75, 80%, perhaps even higher within the next decade. And that's a at that stage, then solar power will be, if not the major, one of the very major sources of our energy, and that's definitely going to be happening. So with the renewables, the prospect of becoming more efficient as we go ahead is actually increasing. Now, that's another big contributor, as to say, to this secular bull market. And then I think also the fact that so many countries rather, have embraced capitalism. It's not always democratic capitalism. A lot of it is command capitalism. But this is very different than when the last secular bull market was beginning back in 1982. And global population is still rising, global middle class is still growing. These are other contributors to this secular bull trend. Okay, what else can we talk about? What about these long-dated government bond yields? I maintain that we have seen the low yields, and those go back right back to the crisis that we saw in 2000 and 8 and early 2000 and 9. Yields have been coming down here recently. There's also a little bit of flattening in that U.S. yield curve, which is a little warning that for stock markets. I don't think it's a serious warning at this stage, but these bond yields are low. I can understand why some people regard them as a safe haven, and I can understand why some people need the certainty, or feel they need the certainty of income in bond investments, but it's not all that great. I personally have a strong preference for autonomies or near autonomies that have attractive yields, where you also have the scope for capital appreciation as well as the as well as the dividends. But bonds are the subject here. My feeling is that as global GDP growth picks up, and there are a lot of concerns about this at the moment, and that's, all right, Europe's recovery is far better than anybody was forecasting a year or two ago, for sure. But growth in Europe is still likely to be on a fits and starts basis, so people will be concerned about that. The concern about China's growth, the concern about Japan's growth, even concern about the USA's growth. So these bond yields will stay certainly reasonably low over the medium term, but over the next few years, I think we will, or a few years down the road, I think we will definitely be seeing higher yields. So from an investment standpoint, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in those low-yielding government bonds. What about currencies? Well, it's hard to make really long-term forecasts on currencies, or it's not prudent to put it that way. But the U.S. dollar is pretty good value overall. Those famous indicators of what do hamburgers cost in the U.S. as opposed to Japan, the U.K., China, anywhere else. And among developed economies, the U.S. dollar, I feel, is very competitive down at these levels, and the U.S. Fed is very happy to keep it very competitive. For the medium term, lengthy medium term at least, until global GDP growth is much stronger. I think you probably won't get a great deal of change there. We're more likely to see more change in the emerging market currencies. But the one that was terrifying everybody last year was India's rupee, which was in free fall until it was announced that the new central bank governor was going to come in last summer, not Narendra Modi. Raghuram Rajan. Is the new central bank governor, and he's been very successful. And so the Indian rupee right now is a very steady, firm currency. The Chinese renminbi, which had been extremely strong until a few months ago, is a very much very controlled currency, obviously, and it's been devalued, and if China's economic problems continue over the medium term, that's we'll probably see a little bit further weakness in that currency. My feeling is that the euro up at 140 against the U.S. dollar, which we saw not long ago, is too high, and more importantly, the ECB, European Central Bank, was not at all happy with it. It's just below 137 here right now, but I think that's likely to range a little lower over the next 3 months. Sterling, I think we're currently at one just above 1.68 against the U.S. dollar. The UK's growth rate is okay, and the central bank is talking about raising short-term interest rates over the medium term, so that could easily underpin sterling for a while longer, although there are major electoral events coming up. Scotland's independent vote in September, the general election in 2015. Sterling won't be appreciating if the Conservatives are overthrown, that's for sure. But I think that extreme currency weakness will be the exception rather than a common event taking place overall. Now, let's look at these commodity markets. What about gold and other precious metals here? I think that it's a difficult call here. I do feel that it's a safer call is to say that there's more medium to longer term upside scope than downside scope. We have a number of large investment banks that are have been quite aggressively talking gold down. And my feeling is that they just like to buy it lower, and they might also have some short positions, and that they're hoping will be profitable or remain profitable. On the other hand, gold is being accumulated in China on a major basis. Gold is also likely to be contributed more, bought more in India, maybe not in the short term, but over the medium term, I think that's virtually certain. Remember, the Congress government put a tax on gold, and that really cut demand. And the BJP has been talking about reducing that. I would be surprised if that happened quickly, but it will certainly happen over the medium term if India's economy is doing well, as I suspect we will see. So my feeling is that there are it's a question of whether the USA in particular can, and the investment houses that I was talking about can push gold lower in the short to medium term. I think it's maybe 60-40 that the lows will hold that we've seen, that we saw last year, and that we'll see gold range sideways to higher, and other precious metals doing reasonably well, with palladium and platinum probably outperforming gold on the upside due to supply concerns. Silver is always interesting. That's high beta gold. And when we currently silver is underperforming gold, it's a good indicator. When silver starts to outperform gold, then I think we will be seeing the emergence of a potentially significant move to the upside. So I'm cautious on gold. A lot of uncertainties, but long-term bull. Industrial metal prices, well, I think they may well range for a longer period, but I think the companies are getting a little bit smarter. They're also taking advantage of new technologies. When I say getting a little bit smarter, we're not getting quite so many mining projects, and I think they're more concerned about their finances. That will be better for the actual mining shares, but it will also, I think, potentially lower supply somewhat. And we got into a big oversupply situation when mining companies were convinced that China was going to produce anything that could be taken out of the was would consume rather China would consume anything that could be taken out of the ground. So we're moving away from that kind of thinking, have moved away from that kind of thinking. My guess is that they range sideways to higher, and that's what we've seen with the commodity indices. Weather's always the key variable in terms of agricultural commodities, as you know, and I won't make a long-term forecast on the weather. And I hope I've touched on most of the bases that you wanted me to, and I apologize if I've said too much. And so it's now down to me to just wish you an excellent weekend. All the best.